As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Jonathan Ferro, along with Lisa Abramowitz and Anne-Marie Hordern. Join us each day for insight from the best in markets, economics, and geopolitics. From our global headquarters in New York City, we are live on Bloomberg Television weekday mornings from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And as always, on the Bloomberg Terminal and the Bloomberg Business App.
Morgan Stanley's Mike Wilson saying this: we believe equity markets have been trading poorly in April, primarily due to the repricing of Fed cuts. With 10-year yields now well above our key 435-440 target, stock appreciation from here would largely have to be earned through earnings upside rather than multiple expansion. Mike, I'm pleased to say, is with us around the table. Mike, good morning to you.
Good morning.
How high is the bar, or low, for those tech firms through this week?
Well, it's mixed, as you were saying. It's not all one trade anymore. It's sort of the Magnificent Three or Four. Some are falling by the wayside for fundamental reasons. Some are falling by the wayside for rate reasons. And look, they've got tougher comparisons now. So I think that, look, as always the case, right? It's not so much about the earnings results. It's about the reaction of the stock to the earnings results. And I think that's what I'm really fascinated to see, how much goodness is already priced into even the winners. And there are some big winners in that group. I agree with you, Lisa. I think what's more interesting is what's going on away from those stocks. That will inform us more about what's actually happening in the economy, you know, what the expectations are around Fed, for example, and also some of the geopolitical risk, which I think, you know, that's not our number one concern, but it's also one of the reasons we're overweight energy.
You said we can learn something from the earnings themselves and how the stock responds to them. What have we learned so far as we get deeper into earnings season?
Well, it's about 50-50. So 50% have been up, T+1, 50% have been down. That's worse than normal. This is in line with what we've been saying for quite a while now, as we think now we're in a period of multiple contraction, right? If you think about the last 6 months, all that really happened was, you know, the Fed pivoted, Treasury, I would argue, sort of squeezed the bond market. We had a duration rally into year end, and that affected a huge multiple expansion. You know, it doesn't get a lot of press, but 2024 estimates for the S&P 500 haven't really gone up, okay? They've been sort of flat over that six-month period. It's all multiple expansion. So our call basically is that we thought seven cuts was silly. I think a lot of people agreed with that. And now we're down to 1.5. So why wouldn't multiples come down in that environment? And I think that's what we're facing now during earnings season, is you've got to really put up a serious beat and a revision to the upside for the stock to go up. I'm very curious to see how that plays through the next 2 weeks.
What we're seeing right now in the earnings is not a cohesive story. I mean, honestly, you're seeing some areas where it's cost cutting that's keeping margins afloat, and other areas where you see, you know, for example, demand for trucks in the U.S. going gangbusters. Are you seeing any themes that you can kind of grab onto so far?
The theme is that it's a very unbalanced economy, and that's the theme we've had for a while. So post-COVID, it's just been a very unpredictable environment for a lot of reasons. Some of those things we got really right, some of those things we got really wrong. And I think we're trying to figure out kind of what the next stage is. Let's look at the last year as an example. So a year ago, hard landing, recession was the consensus view. Market overpriced that. Then we got a soft landing priced in 2Q. Then we had a sort of a fiscal sustainability problem where growth got too hot and rates went up and we had a big correction. Then we went back to the soft landing. And now we're in no landing. So this is our view at the beginning of the year. It's like there's a third of a percent. There's a 33% chance of all three of those happening. Soft landing, no landing, hard landing. And I think it's the same. So in other words, right now we're trying to price that no landing scenario, but I'm not confident that we're going to stay in that environment. And companies are a reflection of that, right? Some companies do better in that scenario. That's why they're doing better, things like energy, materials, financials. But is that sustainable? We're going to find out.
You know, we said that we're going to see how much multiple expansion can continue and whether we see multiple contraction. The multiple expansion has been really concentrated in big tech. It has been really concentrated in some of the quality names that you like. It has not been concentrated in the Russell 2000, which has not experienced that same kind of run. Do you start to like some of those areas because suddenly it is an economy that's okay, maybe supported by a couple rate cuts, and frankly, you haven't seen that multiple expansion?
Well, we did. I mean, November and December was one of the biggest short squeezes I've ever seen in the lower quality parts of the market. So we did absolutely see multiple expansion. Now we're giving some of that back, right? And that's our call, which is that I don't really want to go to the low quality world, okay? And that includes small caps. Not all small cap companies are low quality, just to be clear. But as a group, okay, Russell 2000 is a low quality index. And that's why it's underperforming again, because rates are too high for them, right? They, like R-Star, people talk about R-Star, okay? Well, R-Star is different depending on who you are and what kind of company you run. It's extremely variable, and the market's been really efficient, Lisa, in saying, look, rates are too high for a majority of the economy, whether it's consumers or small businesses. So we're sticking with that. Until rates really get cut, we think that the trade is still, you got to go with self-funding businesses that have idiosyncratic kind of growth opportunities or pricing power, and it's playing out again this year in space.
A lot of people think about you as a bear because yesterday, for last year, I should say, you were really calling for some sort of downturn in the economy. Where are we in terms of that cycle, in terms of just how close we are to a downturn? Are you basically saying, you know what, this isn't something you can really call with any definitive conviction, that you have to sort of just look at specific companies and stay away from that stuff?
You know, it's a humbling business. And I think, 70% of the street, I think, was in the recession camp a year ago. Our economists were not, but like a lot of people were in that camp. And we had to reprice that out. So where are we? We think we're still very much late cycle. I heard you all chatting. One of the questions we've had is, well, why can't it be early cycle? Okay. Well, there's a lot of reasons why we don't think it's early cycle. Labor market's very tight. The yield curve is still inverted. We don't have a lot of supply in the labor market. We have immigration maybe supporting that, but generally it's a tight labor market. You know, margins are still at record high levels. So all of the things that we would look at from an early cycle perspective are just not there. So we're still late cycle. And what does that mean? It means this can last for another 2 years, or it could be over tomorrow if we have another shock. So we're probably going to sit around. We're not going to be as aggressive trying to make that shock because we don't know what it is. We thought it was a regional banking crisis last year. Turned out to be not the case. The economy turned out to be stronger. I would also argue that we have an incredibly imbalanced policy mix, which has helped the economy to sustain itself. So economic data does not look like the earnings data to us. Okay, economic data is much stronger than the earnings data. Why is that? An enormous amount of fiscal support into the economy is keeping the economic data looking strong, which is preventing the Fed from really cutting rates for an early cycle rotation. And that's, we're just kind of stuck in that. And we could be there for a while. Like, I don't see that breaking. I don't see any discipline in Congress. We're spending more money this week with this bill. I mean, so that is where we are. The question is that overpriced? And I think it is, because should I pay a higher multiple for what I call low quality growth? Government sort of driven growth? I would argue no. For some companies, you can pay a higher multiple because they're idiosyncratic to that. And that's what's happening. Companies that don't need government support are doing better. Companies that, you know, are getting constrained by higher rates are underperforming.
Let's talk about fiscal and the fact that it doesn't matter who wins the election. There's going to be more money coming out of Washington. It's one of your questions you ask in your note. How are you thinking about the election as a driver of markets this year? Is it too soon to start preparing for November?
Yeah, I mean, historically, we put this in a note. I mean, typically the volatility of the market picks up 2 to 3 months before the election. My experience is that until we have the conventions and we really see the platforms at the stock level, we don't see a lot of action. Now, interestingly, this year, the market has rallied in the beginning of the year. Typically, it doesn't do well in the first half, and it does better in the second half as it becomes more clear. So is that going to reverse this year? We have a tougher second half? Maybe. But I agree with your first, you know, sort of position, which is I don't see a lot of difference between these two campaigns in terms of the fiscal and even the monetary mix. The one thing I would say is focus on the areas where the president can do things that are executive order. Okay, and the biggest one in my mind is
tariffs.
Immigration.
Oh.
And tariffs, the second one. That's the second one. So tariffs and immigration can be done without congressional voting. So that's where I think Because I'm not confident that we're going to get a sweep either way. That's probably the least likely outcome. It's probably a 10% chance. It's going to be very close. But to get one party as a sweep, I think it's going to be challenging. So the executive order lever, if you're thinking about Trump or Biden, that's where the action's going to be.
I just want to work that through an extra step. Are you suggesting that maybe if we get a President Trump volume two, that this supply side nirvana that some people in the world of economics are embracing might be threatened?
I think that's exactly right. I would argue that there's a chance that maybe something is done prior to the election for political reasons, because this is a hot issue for the election, right? Immigration is a hot topic. And the question is, do they try to curtail some of that inflow prior to the election? I have no idea. But we're going to learn more about that, I think, in the conventions in terms of how they're talking about it.
To your point, then, Mike, this could change quickly in the space of a couple of months. I'm just trying to work out how quickly that would show up in the data, how quickly the market might respond to that change.
Well, here's the real takeaway, John. I feel like there's been a lot of marking to market going on, right?
Okay.
So I would argue everybody's been wrong about the fundamental picture in many, many ways over the last 2 years, including ourselves, okay? And that marking to market, all of a sudden you mark yourself to market, why are you any more confident you know what's going to happen next, right? And that's where we have a problem with valuations, is there seems to be this perceived certainty again being priced in. It's like, I'm not certain at all. Maybe I'm the dummy in the room. I don't know. But like, I feel like there's a little bit of complacency around just knowing what's going to happen. By the way, that's not all bad. There could be some positive surprises, but those positive surprises may lead you to a different group of assets that you want to own, okay? I mean, I think bonds are, just to spend a minute on bonds.
Sure.
My goodness, I mean, this is one where I literally could flip a coin and I would fit, okay, that's it. You know, because I could see rates higher from the standpoint of fiscal sustainability problems. We have a term premium increase like last year. Or I could see things slow down again, because rates are now higher, right? The wealth effect is kind of being priced out of the market, and maybe things slow again. Our house call is we're going back to sort of 415. I think you just had a guest saying 375.
Yeah.
I mean, 375 would argue that we're probably back into a soft landing or hard landing scenario. 415 is kind of more of the things just kind of slow down a bit.
Can I put you on the spot just a little bit? Is it easier to foresee than being 100 basis points lower than being 100 basis points higher? Or you actually think it's a coin split? Yeah.
100's big.
Okay.
And those are the tails, right? So 100 on the upside would be the market is really concerned about funding sustainability, almost like the UK, okay, 2 years ago. And I think 100 basis points lower from here is kind of a hard landing.
Give me the next 50.
Yeah, so 50, I'm still leaning to higher.
Okay.
But our house call is lower, so, you know, and I got to go with the house call.
Because, not trying to cause trouble here, Mike.
No, they're bond, but they're, but I mean, but the bond guys, I mean, that's their job. And so I got to bet with them.
Okay.
And so that would be, okay, so what happens in that scenario for stocks? Well, all of a sudden our no landing scenario probably isn't the case. And we probably would downgrade energy and we probably would go back to some of the things that were doing better last year. And so it's just, I think you just got to keep a really flexible, open mind. That's what we try to do now with the stock picking. We haven't really talked much about index in the last 4 or 5 months because we're trying to focus on the relative value trades. And we've gotten a lot of those right. And hopefully, knock on wood, we can continue to do that.
Stick with us, Mike. You're going to stay close. Mike Wilson there of Morgan Stanley.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Matt is with us now for more. Matt, congratulations, because I think a lot of people have moved to your view of the world. You were talking about a mid-cycle adjustment quite a while ago, and I think everyone else has caught up now. This is no longer about the start of a cutting cycle and perhaps an adjustment mid-cycle. Can you frame the difference and what led you towards that conclusion?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have, I think, two historical examples of mid-cycle adjustments. You had one in the mid-1990s, you had one in 2019. And the logic there is the Fed is cutting rates not necessarily because we're in a recession, but maybe they're seeing some weakness in the economy that they're trying to get ahead of, or they're seeing that inflation's coming down substantially. I think this cycle was going to be all about inflation coming down and the Fed being able to cut rates modestly in response to that. You know, certainly we're seeing that get pushed back. But with the labor market where it is, with growth as resilient as it is, with financial conditions as easy and accommodative as they are, there's really no reason for the Fed to guide towards a full cutting cycle at this point in time.
Pre-pandemic, I remember a phrase that Chairman Powell talked about. The objective was to extend the cycle. Is that the objective now? And where are we in the so-called cycle?
Yeah, I think you've seen Fed officials talking about risk management for a long time over the past 3 years. Risk management has meant being hawkish, raising rates in order to ensure that inflation doesn't become entrenched. I think 3 or 4 months ago, we saw better balancing of those risks as inflation was looking softer and the Fed became a little bit worried about growth. I think the past 3 months of stronger inflation prints have put inflation back to the forefront for the Fed. And extending the cycle at this point, I think, does mean ensuring that inflation does not get entrenched, not cutting rates prematurely. We hear more Fed officials talking about, the risk that's the bigger risk, cutting rates prematurely, having to rehike later.
I like Ben Bernanke's idea of scenario analysis. I would like to have a sense of exactly how the Fed would respond if certain things happen, since it's been such an unpredictable cycle. How many hot inflation prints will it take before we start talking about no hikes this year, or no more cuts this year? And how many weak prints does it take for the Fed to cut?
Yeah, I think we're close to talking about no cuts. Our expectation is the Fed only cuts once, and they cut in December. Well, we also expect that you're going to see disinflation come back over the next several months. So even if you get disinflation, 3-4 months ahead, I think the Fed is going to be a little bit more reluctant to cut rates because they've seen a head fake from the inflation data. It's going to take a while to rebuild that confidence. I think if you take a step back, core PCE inflation on Friday might be 2.7 or 2.8. We have growth, which around 2.25%. We have financial conditions that are easy. We have the labor market, adding more than 200,000 jobs per month on average with a historically low unemployment rate. There's just not very compelling reasons to cut rates within that environment, and I think the Fed is coming around to that view.
How much are they basically also kind of tacitly admitting that the pivot last year really kind of worked against their goal of disinflation, that might have actually contributed to the stickiness that we're seeing right now in some of the data?
I think perhaps it's somewhat of a contributing factor. I think a lot of this is maybe seasonal, so you do have some seasonal factors that boost inflation early in the year. But what that means is the disinflation we saw last year was overstated. And so overall, inflation is just going to be more elevated than we thought. I think financial conditions will help to boost growth as we look ahead. But I don't think that it's been a key factor for the stronger inflation prints of the first 3 months of the year.
Mid-cycle adjustment doesn't sound like we're near any kind of hard landing. And yet the different rolling cycles that we're seeing in a lot of these earnings reports and what people are talking about, the two-sided economy, it's very real. How do you play that out, given the fact that if rates remain at this level, the lower tier, the lower half, frankly, of the population is going to struggle all the much more so? And I'm talking about both companies and individuals.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, that's returning to more normal conditions. It is the reality of the U.S. economy that you have delinquency rates that are more elevated for lower income households, for lower education households. And so a lot of this is returning to a more normal pre-COVID environment as that excess savings gets drawn down. What we've seen in that environment still is robust consumer spending. We saw it with the retail sales report recently. We see GDP growth that looks quite solid. We see employment gains, which are above 200,000. We see households adding meaningful income growth with decelerating inflation. All of that, I think, is pretty supportive for still solid growth for the U.S. economy and something that the Fed shouldn't be worried about.
What about for 2025? How are you thinking about 2025, given the fact that we might have very different policies, fiscal, maybe immigration, coming out of Washington?
No doubt. And I think it's a key challenge to think that the Fed could cut rates in December. So when we change the view and we have one rate cut in December, I think that that could be highly conditional on the election outcome that we get. If you get an election outcome that has meaningful fiscal stimulus and has inflationary policies, whether it's through trade or immigration, the likelihood that the Fed cuts rates in December is reduced. So I do think, as we look about potential to cut rates, the Fed certainly will have to factor in economic policies that will impact inflation, the labor market, and growth. And if those things suggest that they shouldn't cut, then they're less likely to cut.
Let's wrap it up with a counterpoint. Andrew Hornhorst of Citi on the program a little bit earlier this morning. He still thinks mid-year. Only until recently, you were looking for mid-year as well. Yeah. You pushed that back out to December. Can you walk me through how low the bar might be
to a rate cut mid-year. I'm just trying to work out how this market would respond. Let's say in a few weeks' time, get a really soft inflation print. Do the conversations of the last month just disappear and we start going back to what we were talking about 2 months ago? How does all that work?
Yeah, I think to get a cut by June seems very unlikely at this point in time, absent a weakening in the growth environment. To get a cut by July, you know, I think you need to see a pretty quick deceleration in the inflation data, because we've now had three inflation prints that were well above the Fed's objective. We see 3 and 6 month annualized rates, which have been accelerating. It's unlikely you get core PCE inflation down to 2.5% year over year by that period in time. So I think you really need to see a swift and compelling and convincing several prints of weaker inflation data, probably coupled with some weakening of the labor market.
What do you see in the inflation mix right now that makes you think that's very unlikely?
So when you look at things like trim, mean, and median, those things have remained elevated, telling you it's not all about outliers at this point in time. I would also highlight last week we got this new tenant and all-tenant rent index data from the Cleveland Fed. It has a little bit of a lead. And the all-tenant index actually stabilized at elevated levels. And so that tells us at least through Q2, we're unlikely to see shelter inflation decelerate quickly. If that happens, we're unlikely to get the soft inflation the Fed needs.
Matt, this was smart. Always great to catch up. The brilliant Matt Lozzetti there of Deutsche Bank, looking for the first rate cut to come in December and looking for there to be maybe some moderate adjustment in 2025 and what the team over at Deutsche Bank are calling a mid-cycle adjustment.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Vijay, we've got some time with you, I'm pleased to say, to work through a lot of issues. And the go-to question for us on this program over the last few weeks has been, do we have an industry problem here or a Tesla problem? Vijay, which one is it?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think in terms of industry, we have seen a very strong adoption of EVs the last 2-3 years. And now you've gone through the first round of early adopters on EVs. So now getting to the second round is a little bit tougher, as most of the low-hanging fruit has been taken. So you are seeing broadly EV industry face some challenges, especially even in China, significant price competition. But that said, on Tesla specifically, you have a fleet that needs a refresh. People were, investors were looking for the Model 2. So that would be the focus of the earnings call, if the Model 2 is still on track for second half 25, or do we see that get pushed out to 26? Which in which case, you know, 2024 and 2025, you don't have a lot of new models coming to market. So I would say a little bit of both.
Vijay, if we don't have growth, how do you value the growth company? It's a question that Wells Fargo have tried to answer. You've raised this question too. What kind of valuations you put on that name?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really a tale of two scenarios. One is definitely near term, where you have challenging growth expectations because of a fleet that needs a refresh. But longer term, you still have the secular tailwind that electrification is still very much on track, and we will see the global EV market grow significantly as you look out to 2027, 2028, because that's where everybody is placing their chips. I mean, all the global auto OEMs, all, you know, global economies, everybody is pushing on the EV roadmap. So that's where the trend is. Near term, you have some challenges because you're facing a conundrum of lowering pricing, lowering costs to drive sales, and we are not there yet. The EV market still needs to mature to bring costs down, bring ASPs down. And the Model 2 would have been a very welcome addition to that fleet. But you know, looks like there are some question marks around that. So,
given that, what gets us to $195 a share from the current $142 a share on Tesla, as you project?
Yeah, I think a lot of the pullback has been given some of the recent trends in slowing EV sales, but also some doubt around the Model 2 timeline, especially if it's still on second half 25 or 26. I think the more clarity CEO Elon Musk and Tesla can give to the street, the better chance you have for the stock to consolidate or move higher. So I think that's definitely what investors will be focusing on. I think robotaxis are a good roadmap, but obviously there are some significant challenges around regulatory compliance, getting the standards there, getting NHTSA to approve it, putting some guidelines around what is acceptable, what is not acceptable in autopilot, etc. So it's still a roadmap that needs evolving. Might be we see something happening by 2027, 28 at the earliest. So near term, the big focus has to be getting Model 2 back on track. So,
Vijay, we were talking about this with our own Craig Trudell earlier this morning about which Elon Musk would show up to the earnings call. How much does it matter to you, his tone, whether he likes you guys or whether he just excoriates you for boring questions?
I think, we have to disassociate the execution from, basically the valuation should be linked to the execution of the company. And so I think as Tesla has done an excellent job in kind of evangelizing EVs and growing that whole market and being first to market, and they have a massive balance sheet. So all those are not issues. Now the focus should be on getting the product roadmap back on track, getting growth back on track. So I think that's where, that's really what will tie valuation of Tesla stock is really the execution on the product roadmap and how that how that top line margins evolve going out. So,
as it deals with this cost war, this price war in China, was it a mistake to get rid of the cheaper version, $25,000 Tesla?
I think we are not there yet, right? I think there have been press reports to that model gets delayed. There have been Twitter posts about not getting delayed. So I'm sure that's where all the investor questions and focus on the call will be. It's much less focus on what the earnings for the current quarter looks like, because estimates for the current quarter have come down very significantly. So I don't think, there'll be much of any concern around what the numbers are for the quarter and where the margins are. All the questions will be, how does Tesla get through 2024-25? Is the low-cost model still on track, etc.? So I think that's really where the focus will be. That's really where all the questions will be based. So.
And as they plan to roll out the robo-taxi in August, you went through a slew of issues that they have to deal with before August. I mean, this doesn't even have government approval yet. What do you need to hear from Musk today to make you think that, okay, August we can actually see this product?
Yeah, I mean, I think seeing the product is really not a big challenge. I think we can have the product there. The real question would be, okay, what's the execution on it? What's the performance? What's the driver intervention levels? What are the standards we are going to, be guided by in kind of commercializing the robotaxi? How many miles do we have? What's the customer feedback? So there is multiple challenges. There is level 3 autonomy that we haven't even gotten to yet. So I think there are significant challenges to that. And that's why we think any significant rollout will need not just a revamp, an upgrade on the Tesla FSD, but also significant infrastructural upgrades as well. And so it's a route that everybody wants to see happen. We have seen this multiple times before where timelines get pushed out. And at this point, I think it's fair to assume that 2027, 2028 is where we think that there could be any chance of really seeing robotaxis on the road. That's not geofenced, having a little bit more flexibility on where you run it, etc. At this point, it's still in the very early experimental stage. So.
Vijay, let's wrap things up by talking about leadership. Elon Musk wasn't always a polarizing figure. He's been highly successful. It's incredibly unique, the amount of success he's had across various industries. If you think about payments in the early days, the time at PayPal, I go back to what he's doing right now innovations in healthcare. It's unbelievable. At the same time, he's doing things with SpaceX and again with Tesla, and we can talk about Twitter another day. But I think, in fact, think, Vijay, more recently, the experience of Twitter has led to this increased polarization of the man himself. When you have conversations with clients about leadership, do they feel like he's isolating a certain portion of the consumer base?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you look at geniuses, as you mentioned, the list of accomplishments are long. I think they always tend to be eccentric. And so that's exactly why we have to, you know, kind of compartmentalize the execution of the stock and how Tesla itself is doing from personalities. I mean, I know it's very tough to do that, but I think when we look at Tesla and you look at SpaceX, you know, you have to look at how is that company executing? What's the roadmap? Is there something that drives valuations, what drives accretion in this company, et cetera. So, but obviously, you know, like we said, I mean, every genius got there because of their accomplishments, because, you know, and none of them seem to be normal people. They all are eccentric and they all have their quirks. So I wouldn't go there.
It's a double-edged sword. It's very diplomatic, Vijay. Yes. Well navigated. Vijay Rakesh of Mizuho.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast, bringing you the best in markets, economics, and geopolitics. You can watch the show live on Bloomberg TV weekday mornings from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And as always, on the Bloomberg Terminal and the Bloomberg Business App.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.